meantime, the Pratt & Whitney engine was developed primarily under Air Force contract for the Atlas Centaur application. That's where it's still being used. And at that time also, I think Huntsville gave Douglas a contract for the S-4 stage as the second stage for Saturn 1, which would be called Saturn 1B. I'll correct that. The six Pratt & Whitney engines were used on the Saturn 1, this is the second stage.
Yes, four.
And the S-4B actually used then the J-2 engine, as well as the S-4B stage, which is the third stage of Saturn 5. So anyway, in that period, I'd say 60, 61, I'd have to check, the specs were written for this larger LOX hydrogen engine, and there was competition between primarily Pratt & Whitney and Rocketdyne for the engine. And Rocketdyne was awarded the contract. And I'd have to go back and check my, you're probably more familiar now than I am, but I think this was even before the Apollo was announced. I think this was going on. Because I do recall working very hard on the specs for that engine. And I left in June of 1960, so that means those specs were being worked on quite early. As well as the upper stages, the S4, B, and the S2 stage, specs were being prepared that early day. In other words, there was enough knowledge to know that these are the kind of pieces of hardware, and this was going back to the C2 program, probably.
Yeah.
That you would need, you know, these. And very likely the specs didn't have the final configuration, but it had some of the basic dimensions and systems that were required, and we were at that time starting to write those specs, particularly the engine specs. So anyway, I left about that time, and about that time, Rocketdyne got the engine contract, J2. And at that, in their original concept, I don't think they accepted the Pratt & Whitney injector design for obvious reasons. They had to be unique, you know, but yet they were still allowed to give them the contract. So anyway, to make a long story short, I did continue to follow this program, more or less as its government liaison role. As a matter of fact, this came somewhat later, like maybe a year later before I actually got into that position. But even at that time, there was questions on... So anyway, one of the questions that came up on using RigiMesh for the J2 engine was the availability of the material. Because it was sort of a sole source proprietary material, and it was manufactured in sintering furnaces there in Glen Cove, New York. So that was the source. And so the question came up on availability, and I don't recall all the details, but I do recall one story of Dr. Von Braun visiting Rocketdyne, and as he frequently did in these product improvement reviews and engine status program reviews and what have you. And I was told, I wasn't there at the time, but I was told that he just asked him point blank, why didn't they just go ahead and use what had been proven, namely the Pratt & Whitney, injector system and material, and they did it. And then the whole thing was settled from there on out. And it was just a matter of supplying the hardware then, material to Rocketdyne and let them shape it, you know, machine it. It can be handled just like a solid piece of material of the same thickness.
Do you remember who was there and heard Von Braun?
I think Jerry Thompson mentioned this to me, so he would be the best one just to ask for more details on that particular point.
Well, now, were you here in Huntsville, were you talking to somebody in the engine program office about RigiMesh and trying to encourage him to use it?
Yes, I think I continue to, you know, keep some contact with the local engine people. I think I did propose this, you know. They consider this, and they were considering it.
And
the people here were, you know, sort of in favor of it, but I think it was Rocketdyne that was dragging their heels, and I don't know all the factors there, you know, what else they were looking at, frankly. I know they were looking at some of their own unique injector designs, and probably they were, you know, trying to somewhat justify whatever they had proposed. And there was a period there of almost a year when, after I left the propulsion group, and then got more heavily involved in this consulting type activity that I'm not that familiar with, you know, everything that did happen. But by the time I was back in the loop, they still had not made a final decision, I don't think, on the regimash.
Were you talking to Thompson here then?
Yeah, because I was going back into that same old group that I had, you know, worked in, and was talking to them about filters and regimash applications. I became also involved with Pesco Products, division of Morg Warner, as their, well, that's consultant or rep in Huntsville. And they were involved in the boost pumps for the Centaur engine, so they were in liquid hydrogen. So yes, I was in that direct propulsion and propellant system loop. And we were also involved in the preconditioning pumps. I think they were electrically driven for the S4 stage, and eventually the S4B and S2 stage. You have to pre-chill or precondition the temperature of the lines before you go into main stage on a liquid hydrogen engine. These little pre-chilling pumps would perform that function. They would actually start up before you go in, you know, start into engine operation to cool down, so you don't get a gasification ram effect from cold propellants hitting hot lines. So that's another story.
That's kind of off the subject a little bit, but I'm interested in it. I haven't run it down yet. Where were those Pesco pumps used in the Saturn, and what for?
They were used upstream of the liquid hydrogen propellant feed lines coming from your propellant tanks to your engines.
Okay.
And they were used, as I say, to precondition those lines and chill them down. In other words, to get a dynamic flow going through there, because under just a static condition with no flow, you don't get much of a chill down, but you have to actually flow the stuff because it boils off so quickly, you see.
Were they using naloxone lines too, or just hydrogen?
Primarily hydrogen. I think there were possibly some LOX chill down, but I know there were hydrogen. It's not as critical on the LOX side. It's, you know, temperature is not near as low, of course. With hydrogen, it is quite critical. With LOX, it's not that critical.
Okay, so they're upstream in the propellant feed lines to pre-chill those lines.
So what you have
did
to
they
do...
Go through the, is that involved with the engine pre-chill too?
Yeah, you go down as far downstream as you can, and then what you do, you open up a valve during the pre-chill sequence and then circulate it back up again, you say, to your propellant tank.
Yeah.
So what it means, you have a closed loop circulation.
But
because if you didn't have that, if you had just a static condition, you wouldn't have any place to go, yeah, you say.
But they not only chilled the lines in, that Pesco pump pre-chilled the engine too.
Yeah, as much of the engine as you could.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Okay,
this was the same function that the boost pumps had on the Centaur, still have. It's Pesco designed under contract to the Air Force and provided this same role for the Centaur vehicle.
Okay, so when you're talking about engine pre-chill pumps, they're, for example, the J2 restart, they have to go to the pre-chill cycle.
Yeah.
That's a Pesco pump that's doing that.
Not necessarily. I know it was on the... S4B, I'll have to go back and refresh my memory.
Yeah.
Because I'm confusing in my own mind the S4, the S4B, the S2, and even the S1, I think, did have some LOX chill down pumps. And I'd have to look at some schematics, so if I'll beg off.
I had some Pesco products, but they talked about it in such general terms, I just couldn't figure out, you know, exactly where they were used.
Yeah. But that was a function, and I could dig that out for you.
Okay. Do you remember anything about the... more about the manufacturing process of regimash, a little bit how they went into that and how they did it?
Yeah, first, in some cases they would weave their own material, in other cases they would just purchase it as an industrial wire cloth type of thing. And in that form, it's flexible in that there's no interconnection between the individual strands. And this is used for strainers, you know, and wire cloth is used in a lot of industrial applications. And they even, I think, purchased a few of their own weaving companies, I think in Ireland and possibly Germany, to supply the raw material, to make sure you could always have an adequate supply, which is when you're getting big demand, you have to meet the demand, so that means you have to prepare yourself. And anyway, the next step then is to take this and go through a furnace at almost the melting point. So really it's just like a centering furnace on a conveyor belt.
Mm-hmm.
you go through this thing, and the two critical items are the temperature and the time frame, how long it's in there. And if you get these things tuned up, and it's quite an art. And one of the reasons more people aren't doing this is that, you know, it takes a lot of experience. It's kind of like the old guy in the steel mill who knows just when to pour it off. And so anyway, when you do this, out it comes, and it's just like a flat sheet of solid material, except it has little holes in it. And in that form, you can use it, you know, for certain applications. And then say you want to go to the injector face, you need, of course, more thickness. So you might have to require, you know, 7 or 8 layers of this wire cloth. And they seem to favor what they call the Dutch twill weave, which is a specific weave that has a little more rigidity in it, even in its normal state. So it gives you additional strength when it's centered. Okay, so the next step is then to take, say, X number of layers of this stuff after you've, you know, individually process them, and then stack them up and run them through all together in a combined form, a combined composite or matrix of layers. And then that, again, is quite a tricky process because of your heat transfer rate not being uniform, you see. From the outside, the thing to the interior is like cooking a potato. So all of these things had to be considered in the centering process. So like I say, it's somewhat proprietary. Other people do it. It's not, they don't have a monopoly on this technique. For example, Bendix Purilator Division got into it in a big way. They're still involved in this stuff. Mm-hmm. They call their material Poroloy, I believe. But as a matter of interest, Purilator used to have all the aircraft filter business.
Does APM have it now? Most of it?
Yes, and I think Dr. Paul went to Purilator. That was one of the companies he approached, you know, to get their interest up. And he went to a number of others and didn't get any response, so he just said, damn it, I'll do it myself. And that's what he did. He went into the filter business and ended up with the majority of the world market in aircraft filters, which they probably still have today. I haven't checked lately, but I know they did 5 years ago.
So he would supply it to British corporations? French corporations?
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah, it's used worldwide. It's, yeah, it had worldwide representatives cutting this stuff all over the world. And anyway, you're getting back to Regimesh. Then you take the stuff out of the furnace and you test it to make sure it doesn't peel, you know, and it's all centered together properly. And then you have to come up with a given porosity. So you do this by taking it and rolling it through 2 steel rollers and decreasing the thickness, which increases the delta P, or pressure drop, across the thing. And of course, the more you squeeze it, the less porosity you have. So then that step means you can control the, customize more or less whatever type of material you want to develop. And then if you want to further modify it, you can even then take little tiny, let's say the material stainless steel, which in most cases it was, you can take little tiny stainless steel particles and deposit them on the top and even get a filtration action, if you like. So in some of their cases, they would combine powdered metallurgical type processes with woven wire processes, integrate this into the same material. It means you end up with a structurally strong material because of the weaving. You end up with in-depth filtration because of the tiny little balls that are stacked up and centered together and integrated with the woven material. You call this super mesh.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the Regimesh story.
Well, they supplied it then, what, just sheets of material?
Yeah, and still do to people like Pratt & Whitney, GE. Think of any other big engine, man, Allison, I guess. I don't know if they're still in the act or not, but this same material then is being used for noise suppression because it is porous and absorbent, you might say, and cuts down the dB level by dampening out the high frequency vibration for your compressors and turbine blades. And it's somewhat self-cleaning that you can, purge it out. You can use it for, well, one thing that I always thought was interesting was to use this material for cooling turbines. turbine blades to operate at higher temperatures. And this was considered in World War II by the German Junkers people and their jet engine development. The Navy got interested. And there has been...
The U.S. Navy.
Yeah, U.S. Navy. Because I think they captured that particular group of engineers brought them over here. There's a lot of that going on, you know.
Yeah.
After
yeah.
World War II. And over the years, I think the Air Force, NASA Lewis probably, I know NASA Lewis, the Navy and other people have looked at this possibility of using porous turbine blades. To me, that would be one of the more outstanding applications if and when it evolves. Because then you can, you know, raise your temperature, combustion temperature, and operate at much higher temperature, giving you a much more compact and efficient turbines, jet turbines.
Offhand, do you know of any other rocket engines besides the RL-10 and the J-2 that you used in?
I was quite heavily involved personally in a lot of experimental work that was going on here, looking at the so-called toroidal thrust chamber. There was a lot of experimental work there. Rocketdyne eventually built, you know, some of these engines under contract. And that was one of the materials being considered there for the injector on the inside of the engine. And there were some others, small engine concepts that were played around with here, but as it turned out, these never were used.
See, there's something else I was going to ask you, too. In making the J2 injector phase, they used electrical discharge machining. And so the rigid mesh is the material that they were working with.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would just go through there, and then they would put in another
orifice, yeah,
solid for the oxidizer,
right,
to go in.
Yeah.
Okay, so that explains that.
Mm-hmm. That's almost identical to the Pratt & Whitney system. Oh, the other big application was the M1 engine. And Aerojet bought quite a quantity of the same material, and it was under a NASA contract to develop a large million-pound thrust liquid hydrogen engine, originally as a Nova upper stage engine. That program eventually died out. And I'm not sure on the Nerva engine, you know, which is the Aerojet Westinghouse nuclear engine, whether Richard Mesh was used or not. I'm really not sure. For the, I kind of doubt it, because it's just a heat engine, and all you're doing is dumping liquid hydrogen into it and expanding it, you know, in the form of gas for your thrust. And in that case, I don't think the injector phase is that critical. I'm not sure. But the M1 would have been another big application.
It's really a beautiful story, Dave. It's really a nice one. I like that.
Okay.